This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 4th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24 in association with Squarespace. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. In this episode of the show, we set sail for the shores of Catalonia to see for ourselves how one stationery maker has sought inspiration from the Mediterranean.
It's all about finding like little stories and then really transform them into objects and actually infuse the objects with the story.
Then we head to Queens, where a brotherly duo of designers has come up with a nifty new product beating an innovative path in the world of percussion.
We're really trying to capture the full sonic range of a drum and allow drummers to use that range to control electronic sounds in a very similar way.
Plus, we head to a London shop that's doing more than most to encourage young talent and top up its roster of independent designers. All that to come and plenty more besides right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Since it's the beginning of August and the height of the European summer, we at Section D, like many people, have turned our attention to the Mediterranean. Many sun-seeking holiday makers will make their way to Barcelona and take time from their schedules for a quick crossword or to simply jot down a few thoughts for the months to come. Designer Marcel Bayer has created a Mediterranean-themed stationery collection for just this purpose, and his brand Octavio includes handmade notebooks and desk accessories inspired by the Mediterranean, as well as his former sea captain father's tales of adventure. Our correspondent Liam Aldous went along to his studio to talk about the design process and pick up one of the notebooks for himself before embarking on his own summer odyssey.
Octavio is a Barcelona-based company that produces high-quality and refined goods for the desk and home. We have launched about 1 year ago with the first collection of stationery. And all our products are Mediterranean-inspired, meaning we travel the Mediterranean and search for stories and transform them into beautifully crafted goods. As a designer, I always had this kind of passion for stationery, and it was basically trying to mix my passions for storytelling, for traveling, and for adventure into a brand.
So how do you do that? What were some of the sources of your inspiration, the material sources of your inspiration to develop the range?
We have this kind of little notebook called the Philosophy Notes that is inspired by the Greek philosophers. And we have notebooks, there's one called Navigator Notes. It's all inspired by the sea, the tides, the inspiration that flows with the changing tides. It's all about finding like little stories and then really transform them into objects and actually infuse the objects with the story.
Your father was a sea captain.
Yes.
Did any of his past experiences or any of his stories that he came back to tell you, did that feed into your creative process as well?
Of course, he was like a storyteller. He always had like great adventures to tell us. And also he left me like a lot of material, like Super 8 movie material that I actually also kind of used to make a short movie about the brand and to explain it. And there's definitely something about the sense of adventure that I also think I have in myself and that I also try to kind of live, of course. It's a lot of nostalgia, you know, as well. I wouldn't say my products are nostalgic, but we're definitely actually looking back a little bit into a time when like traveling was more kind of glamorous and something that also was a bit more kind of, had probably a bit more of value. Our products are made to be kept. The idea, you know, is a notebook is something very personal. It's a gift in very digital and fast times that we're living in. I think it's a gift to ourselves to just pause for a moment and sometimes take a note and just leave it for a while, come back, take more notes. And I also like to see whenever products age, you know, it's a lot of people actually send photos and illustrations they did, and there's actually something very, very nice to see how the people actually interact with our products.
Let's talk as well about marble notes.
I always like think a little bit back, you know, when you go to Italy or and you have all these like amazing floors and you think of all what happened on these floors, you know, this goes back like hundreds, thousands of years, you know, and it does somehow hold the secrets of centuries, you know, it's smooth, it's still, and it also kind of waits for new stories to be written on it. Octavo also produces like bespoke projects for other brands. We just finished a notebook for a cosmetic brand in Madrid, and we did a very special notebook for a wine festival that happens in the north of Spain last year. So this is also a very important part of Octavo to offer like customized, personalized goods to our clients.
What are your favorite spots in the Mediterranean that also inspire you? Everyone has a few.
Yeah, I like kind of the little streets in Naples, or I like I very much like ports, and I like to see like ships and this kind of, you know, the unloading and this kind of whole kind of busy life that happens in a port. Like the other day I was actually like going a little bit up in Barcelona on a hiking trip, and when you look down to Barcelona it actually looks like this kind of perfect city, you know, you have the airport, you have the mountains, you have the sea, you have like everything is very compact, and I think like Barcelona is actually definitely one of the more interesting cities. What I think is very interesting is the Mediterranean is actually very, very beautiful also in winter. I really like Formentera just before spring and just before winter. It's actually very, very beautiful. There are no tourists and it's very quiet.
Does this mean that when you're traveling now, you're not just taking it all in, you're constantly bringing the connection back to your stationary range, maybe taking photos, just gathering material to roll out your further range?
It's actually happening, yes. I try to sometimes take some days off and just relax. But obviously, if you go like somewhere, even if it's not the Mediterranean, you know, I'm traveling a lot in Asia, you know, and you have to meet shops, you have to meet clients, you have to meet new people, you have to sell. Obviously, it's very important to us. But also, I enjoy very much like meeting all our clients, and that's also like something very, very appreciate about this project, the relationship that we can build up with our clients and stores, and the stories behind all these, like also other small entrepreneurs, people who have build up their own shops, and that's something very, very beautiful. And even though it's work, I still enjoy.
That was Monocle's correspondent Liam Aldous speaking to Marcel Bayer about his Mediterranean-inspired selection of stationery from Barcelona-based brand Octavio. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Now, there's nothing retailers like more than to showcase new and emerging design talent, but with innumerable new fashion brands and labels springing up, it can be hard to keep a pace of the change. Since 2009, London's well-heeled Mayfair has hosted Wolf and Badger, a concept store created to support and sell only the newest and most exciting of independent fashion and design brands from the world over. In an announcement made last week, Wolf and Badger is to merge with leading online marketplace Bottega. But how does this new retail powerhouse make its buying and forecasting decisions? And how do up-and-coming designers actually enter the fray? To find out more, Monocle's very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco went to the Mayfair shop of Wolf and Badger to meet its creative director, Henry Graham.
We started the business. My brother and I, George, started the business with an idea in 2009 to help young brands retail directly to customers, essentially. And we looked at the existing way people went about stocking and buying and selling young fashion brands and felt that it was very much weighted towards the big retailers and didn't really give any power to the small brands. So we started it with a dream of really making things easier for new emerging designers, and rented essentially a store in Notting Hill in 2010 and divided it up and sold 70 different collections from 70 different designers to the customers that were living and working around the Notting Hill area. And it really immediately became a huge success, and people were loving the edits and the fresh styles of apparel and accessories and jewelry that we were showcasing. And since then, we've really developed what was a kind of a really quite a small idea into something that we hope will reach a much more global audience.
If I'm a new designer, what's the process? How do you choose the brands you want to work with? What's the kind of business deal you do with those new brands?
So originally, we had to go out and look for brands, and inform them and educate them about what we were doing and why we were different from a normal boutique that is buying and selling stock or working on a sale or return basis. Now, fortunately, because of the reputation that we have carefully built up over the last 5-6 years, we have brands coming to us every day. So we have maybe 5, 6, 7 applications from designers reaching out to us, either directly walking into the store and saying, hey, I'm making these amazing things, what do you think of them? Or via our website. And then I personally go through all of the applications and arrange meetings with the short list of brands that I think are the most appropriate for the customers that we have. We tend to turn away about 90 to 95% of the brands that apply to stock with us, usually because they are not of sufficient quality in terms of the design or the manufacture, but often because they're also too similar to another brand that we carry. And I'm sure you'll gather from being in the store or looking on our website that we are quite eclectic in terms of the buy that we do. And that is very much because we are trying to showcase a kind of a well-rounded range of products that's going to suit you, whether you're a man, woman, young, old, so on.
I just want more of a profile of the brands. You know, are they mainly British perhaps, or, and how many brands are you working with at the moment?
We work with predominantly British brands, although that is becoming more and more international as we grow our web business and as we grow the business overall. We have about 70 to 80% UK brands, although we are always happy to work with the best emerging luxury brands from around the world. We work with about 70 to 75 designers per store, and we have 2 stores, one in Dover Street where we're currently sitting and one in Notting Hill, which was our first boutique. And then we work with about another 350 designers online only. So in total, we're currently carrying about 500 different brands online in total.
So there is a difference for online. So for example, a brand can perhaps show for about 3-6 months in the shop, but then they can go online for indefinite time.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Often brands will stay with us in store, and the average period that they stay in store actually is about a year rather than 3 or 6 months, although we do have flexible contract terms and designers do stay from as little as 3 months, and some have been with us since we launched 5.5 years later. But the online gives us an opportunity to carry on working with the brands that have outgrown us and have become, in some cases, large brands in their own right and have been picked up by other large retailers like Net-a-Porter or people like that, but wish to carry on the relationship with us as they've become a bigger business.
I want to talk a little bit about expansion plans. I mean, I believe this week you merged with online marketplace Bottica.com. And can you tell us why did you decide to merge, and is it part of an expansion for Wolf & Badger?
It's very much part of an expansion for us. We started as a single boutique doing serviced retail. What that means is essentially we provide a fully serviced luxury platform for a brand within a store. So that rather than renting your own store or renting a stall on a market, we were providing something in between where you can have a fully staffed rail or jewelry cabinet in a prime location. And that's what we mean by serviced. And subsequently, we have grown the business. As I said, we've opened another store, we've built the online business, and we've massively increased the number of brands that we're working with. Clearly, the main service that we provide is showcasing and selling these products to people that are interested in seeing these products, as well as educating the consumers that doesn't necessarily know about the brands that we're selling. But it always becomes interesting when you meet another business that was doing something complementary to what you're doing. And we had known Bottica for a long time, and they were just online and just selling accessories and jewelry, whereas we do accessories, jewelry, homeware, fashion, a wider range essentially of products. We felt that bringing our stores and online business together with their strong online business and merging the two together made a lot of sense, and that was really the rationale for doing it.
You know, I was browsing through the shop here as well. I don't know if you can mention some of the brands. For example, there's a very nice kind of very lovely socks there as well. Yeah. So it is, there's a lot of originality as well. I like what you said. So you don't want brands who are kind of copying or mimicking other or the brands. So I guess you praise originality as a plus if you want to be at Wolf & Badger.
That's totally right. I think you've summed it up very well there, actually. We are not looking for something you have seen before. Obviously, total originality is impossible to find. Everything is influenced by something. However, one of the main criteria I look for when deciding which brands to work with is how original the collection is in whole, or certainly how much originality is coming across when one looks at it with fresh eyes. And certainly with that sock brand, London Sock Co., who you notice and who I'm wearing currently, have a very interesting design aesthetic. And yes, it is a classic, it is a sock, but they've taken that and they've reinvented it and made it a little bit more contemporary. And that's very much an approach that we share with all of the brands that we carry.
That was Monocle's fashion forward, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, in conversation with Henry Graham, the creative director of London retailer Wolf and Badger. Still to come on the show, we discuss the merits and pitfalls of competitions in architecture with Arc Daily's editor James Taylor Foster. Plus, we head to Queens to march to the beat of a different drum and hear all about a percussive new product.
Great design tells stories, and Squarespace's innovative website building tool is the perfect platform from which to tell them beautifully. Showcase your creativity, ideas, and business in style with Squarespace's unrivaled range of online products and services. To see how it could work for you and for a 10% discount, head to squarespace.com and enter the promotion code Monocle. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. With their obligatory deadline-driven all-night work and frantic submission stories, competitions are integral to stimulating innovation and enabling fledgling talent to break ground in the design industry. This applies especially to the field of architecture, where real projects are few and far between, and recognition is enough to transform a practice's reputation and the opportunities available to it. It's a subject we discuss a lot right here on Section D, but The Urbanist, our city-themed show, also examined the theme this week in a show entitled Failed Bids. In an interview extended for Section D, Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan caught up with the Arc Daily editor James Taylor Foster to learn more about the culture of competitions within the architectural profession.
Maybe you could begin just by explaining how important competitions are in the world of architecture.
They're absolutely integral. I mean, we can go back to the 15th century when Filippo Brunelleschi, who is the designer of the dome of Santa Maria del Fiore, which is the Florence Cathedral, entered a competition to design some bronze doors. And then a few years later, he got commissioned to design the dome, and this dome has become absolutely iconic. And I think that's probably the first major competition in architecture that exists. But that model works, and the model hasn't really changed throughout the years. The idea that a group of people all compete for one project with a variety of ideas brings a whole scope to the possibilities for one site, for example, and it helps clients to make an informed decision. And it also builds a kind of a nice relationship between architects who all have different approaches. So I think it's totally integral.
How can winning a competition affect an architect's career?
I think enormously, because what it shows is a degree of credibility, a degree of recognition from the profession that you exist within. And I think that's what you're really searching for, because unlike artists, your buildings take a very, very long time to get built. People put up enormous amounts of money and they make a lasting impact on the skyline or the urban area of a city. And so to actually get to that point, you have to really prove that you're worth it. And so it brings enormous credibility.
Young architects coming out of training, how conscious are they of the culture of competition within the architecture practice? Do schools tend to prepare them to enter competitions? Are there competitions held within schools themselves which mirror the dynamics of competition in the external world? Or is it something that they try to ignore?
No, definitely not ignore. It's actually integral. I think most students in university will be operating within a system where the projects that they're doing are fairly short. They maybe last 3 months. And so the time frame is similar to that of a competition, maybe a bit longer. But also, most ambitious architecture students will probably be entering competitions outside of university, because it's still the key way to be recognized by the profession. And I think if you win a competition while you're studying, it's demonstration that you can go above and beyond the university environment.
How many competitions result in the realization of the winning plan?
I think most do, because nowadays, especially most competitions are in the public eye. And so you expect, the public expect to see something from it in the end. And I know a lot of competitions now are actually subject to public votes, which I think is interesting in terms of the digital age, because the votes are usually done through online mechanisms. But ultimately, like I said before, because of the sheer investment in these things, sometimes they never make it. And I would say probably 70% of competitions do get built, 30% disappear. But within that 70%, there's obviously a lot of grey area between whether the actual original idea gets built in the original way or whether it becomes distorted and twisted and turns into something very, very different.
I'm very interested in this democratic mechanism that you mentioned in some competitions, because there's famously a disparity between what the avant-garde of architects think is good and public opinion about what's pretty in the public spaces. Is there an example of a competition where the democratic mechanism is decisive? And are there any examples of buildings that have been built as a result of winning such a competition?
Well, I mean, at the moment, in fact, I engaged in one of these recently in Den Bosch in the Netherlands. There's a big new theatre complex being built, and it got whittled down to two practices, and the public decided. And as far as we're aware at the moment, the public choice is going ahead. But also, you've got to remember that when it comes to very, very, very big, large-scale projects, which do have kind of will have a significant impact, public opinion doesn't necessarily have to be expressed through a vote or through a simple mechanism. Public opinion can be expressed through very different ways, like we've just seen in Tokyo with the Tokyo National Stadium and for the 2020 Olympics, and the fact that the architects have been completely thrown out due to a public backlash.
Mm. And what would your advice to a young architect be? Enter all competitions they can get their hands on? Only some of them? In which case, which types? Or none at all?
I think you've got to be very careful about what you enter, because the expense of time is enormous on these things. So you have to be quite tactical. You have to look at competitions which you think will lead to something, lead to a built project maybe, though these are few and far between. Or you have to be tactical about how many entrants you think will be in the competition, how best your chances are. Or you simply go for conceptual competitions which allow you to refine, distill, explore your identity as a designer and develop yourself to a point where you can be distinguished from others, and then you win the big ones.
That was, of course, Monocle's inimitable Henry Rhys Sheridan speaking to Arc Daily editor James Taylor Foster. And you can hear more of that interview by tuning into The Urbanist with our editor Andrew Tuck from Thursday at 1900 hours London time. The theme this week will be failed bids. To end the show with a bang, we immerse ourselves in the world of music and sound design. Electronic music can be enthralling, but it can also sometimes lack a human touch that's available with its more classic counterparts. Bringing a physicality and human movement to produce a new range of sounds is what brothers Tala Kayal and Tinoch Esparza are doing at Sensory Percussion. The pair launched a successful Kickstarter campaign to add a new dimension to the sound of drums. The nifty product they've designed is attached to a set of drums and brings an extraordinary new range of sounds to this often abashed musical instrument. Monocle's Joey Edwards travelled to Sensory Percussion Studio in Queens to chat with Tala Kayal and learn more about how this all works.
So can you tell me a little bit about Sensory Percussion?
So Sensory Percussion is a new system that really aims to capture the nuance of acoustic drumming and allow drummers to use all of the nuance that they're used to when playing acoustic drums in order to control electronic sounds. So this is a pretty big departure from the current electronic drums that are out there that are really more like kind of buttons disguised as drums or just straight up buttons that you hit with drumsticks. We're really trying to capture the full sonic range of a drum and allow drummers to use that range to control electronic sounds in a very similar way.
Can you demonstrate how it works?
So when you first set up the system, you have to teach the system how you're individual drum sounds, and so you play it in all the different ways in which you want it to respond, and then from there you can map whatever sounds and effects to follow your playing. So you can map different sounds to correspond to different regions. but you can also make it so that your playing changes some effect. So on the drum head, I have really just one tom sound, but I'm pitch shifting it depending on where I'm hitting the drum. You know, it's an extreme effect, and that kind of control wasn't really possible before. And that's a very extreme effect just to demonstrate the kind of sensitivity that you can get off of just the drum head. So you can use any surface of the drum to control an effect on top of samples or synths, and that really kind of ties the acoustics of the drum to the electronic output that you're hearing and kind of translates your actual drumming through electronics.
So one of my favorite things about the system is the way that you can play between sounds. Can you explain to our listeners a little bit about that?
You can, with our system, make it so that each part of the drum gives you some sample or some different sound and turn it into a sample pad of sorts, very similar to like a Roland SPDS, where you have these individual buttons that give you one sound. But what the system does beyond that, that none of the other systems can do, is allow you to control blending between sounds and kind of erase sonic borders. So right now I have two sounds associated to the center of the drum and the edge of the drum. And if I play in between there, there's gonna be a breaking point. But with our software, set it up to blend between those sounds so that awkward border is erased and it'll become a much more natural playing surface. So now there's no boundary between the two, and I have these two different timbral regions that are blending in a very smooth way, depending on where I'm hitting the drum. So now it's really a lot like a natural drum.
How does Century Percussion compare to a Trigger?
Our software is very sensitive to fine movements and rolls and, you know, whatever rudiments or fast playing you want to do. So you can do things like this. Drumming has a very physical genius to it. The kinetic nature of it, the movements involved, and the rhythms that that produces, and the kind of phrasing and musicality that arises out of that physicality cannot be recreated with a sequencer or with sample pads or with any other process, really. It's very unique to the human body and to the drums and to this art form that is really, you know, the original music. The idea is to really bridge the two worlds from the acoustic to the digital so that drummers aren't limited by these acoustic instruments anymore sonically, but they can still wield that power of physicality over electronic processes.
That was Monocle's Joey Edwards in conversation with Talakayel Esparza, co-creator of Sensory Percussion in New York. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. We'll be back at the same time next week, and don't forget, if you missed any of this week's show or fancy catching up on our back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com, SoundCloud, or iTunes to listen again. As always, today's show was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can also contact the show's producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com with any comments, queries, or suggestions. As always, thanks for listening, and goodbye.